Come to order. Thank you, everybody, for coming tonight. I'm Paul Thiessen, and I'm chair of the House of Representatives Health and Human Services Policy Committee. And we're really excited to be up here tonight to talk to you. We took a tour of the hospital earlier today, which was really helpful to see and to get some indication of what's going on the ground. And really, that's why we're here tonight. We're going to have a couple of presentations. Thank you. On issues related to healthcare and its delivery and access and all those issues in rural Minnesota, in greater Minnesota. And then we'll have a further discussion with anybody that's interested in talking or sharing any of their experiences with us. So welcome. But I thought before we do that, why don't we, starting this way and then we can go that way, introduce the rest of the folks that are here.
Starting which way? This way?
Sure.
I'm Tom Emmer. I'm on the far right of Chairman Thiessen. I'm a Republican that represents the eastern half of Wright County, which is about 30 to 45 miles west of Minneapolis-St. Paul.
I'm Matt Dean, and I represent areas of northern Washington County, including Stillwater.
Representative Julie Bond, and I represent the area just south of Representative Dean from Stillwater down to Woodbury.
I'm Joyce Pepp, and I represent House District 32A, which includes Maple Grove and Rogers and five other communities.
And I'm Representative Diane Loeffler from Northeast Minneapolis. It's the most range-like part of Minneapolis.
I'm Tom Huntley, state rep from the city of Duluth, the eastern part of Duluth, and I'm chair of the Health Care and Human Services Finance Committee.
I'm Larry Hosh. I represent central Minnesota and Stearns County, including the communities of St. Joseph, Painesville, Cold Spring, Kimball, Clearwater, and Eden Valley.
I'm Erin Murphy, and I'm a state representative from St. Paul.
Tony Sertich, I have the honor of being right here in the heart of my district, and I want to personally thank all the legislators and staff who chose us as a spot to come have a listening tour, and I really appreciate you all taking time to come up here tonight. And I know there's one other legislator in the back corner that we can't forget.
Hi. Very Minnesotan of you. So they know who he is. So, Tom, thank you for coming. Well, we're going to start tonight with what I think is a very interesting analysis that's ongoing, but that we can see the first pieces of it. Dr. Lana Knutson will do the presentation, and it's some research that she and others have done in rural Minnesota and in other states as well, but to give us a sense of really what's going on the ground with regard to healthcare. So, Dr. Knutson, please.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting us to have an opportunity to share our findings with your committee and with community members. I just want to, by introduction, let you know that this is a community project, if you will. I'm talking community very broadly, including the Access Project, which is actually located in Boston, Massachusetts, but it's led by your very own Minnesotan, Mark Rukavina. So somehow we're all connected in this. First of all, let me just share a little bit with you about who the Access Project is. It is a national research and advocacy organization, and it supports local access improvement efforts. Its mission is to work to strengthen community action, promote social change, and improve health, especially for those who are most vulnerable. And this organization started about 10 years ago with funding from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and has been going forward since that time. It also provides a lot of technical assistance to local communities and states, and they have a particular interest in rural health. I'm one of the partner organizations, and I'm from the Center for Rural Health at the University of North Dakota. And we actually have one of the oldest centers for rural health in the country. It's almost 30 years old. And we are located at the School of Medicine and Health Sciences at Grand Forks. We focus on a variety of things, as you can see, including a lot of work in communities, as well as research in areas of Native American health, rural health workforce, rural health services, and rural health policy. The Access Project also has the opportunity to leverage some expertise from Brandeis University, in particular the Institute for Health Policy that's at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management. And they are the group that has been providing the technical statistical assistance for this project. Now you may wonder, how in the world did these characters all get together? Well, in 2006, the Access Project actually published a report based on findings that they had with a group in Kansas. They actually partnered with the Kansas Farmers Union to look at uninsured in Kansas. And what they were really interested in was starting to develop a portfolio of work looking at small businesses. And because farmers, for the most part, are small businesses, they thought that that would be a really good group to do some outreach with. They'd also done a lot of work with fishermen. And how we got involved was in 2000, I actually conducted a survey of North Dakota farmers in our state. And prior to that, in the mid-90s, had done a lot of work looking at access to health insurance in our state. And we had implemented some incremental reforms that we saw actually had made some difference. Our policy changes actually impacted and lowered the rate of the uninsured in our state. So we all got together and talked about what kind of opportunities there might be if we joined forces. What resulted is the 2007 study of financial burdens of healthcare on farm and ranch operators. And we took advantage of looking at seven states, including Minnesota, Montana, Missouri, Nebraska, North Dakota, and South Dakota. And in doing so, we also partnered with the USDA's National Agricultural Statistical Services out of Fargo. So we tried to be as homegrown as we possibly could. And what is a really neat aspect of this project is that we have been working very closely with all of our partners that are offices of rural health in all seven states. And that's how I have gotten to know Mark better, as well as working with our own state, Lynette Dixon. And ultimately, what we really wanted to look at was the financial burden of healthcare costs on farm and ranch operators, as well as the different challenges that people are facing in the health insurance market. Just to give you an overview, we looked at a lot of different issues about health insurance coverage, from where people actually got their health insurance, be it from group and employer-based health insurance or individual market, as well as looking at out-of-pocket expenses, financial burden, medical debt, and access to care. We can learn a lot of things from this kind of a survey, and one of the things that we're really interested in looking at is the relationship between health insurance characteristics and its access to care, and also how those different products in the market are impacting people's financial stability and viability. As I said, we contracted with USDA, and we conducted a telephone survey including farmers, you know, in all seven states over the time period of March, February to March. And why was that such a good time? They weren't in the field. And we had tremendous response rate. We had almost an 80% response rate. And one of the comments that we continued to get from people unsolicited was, please do something about this, because this is a very important issue for us, and that's why we're taking the time to respond to your survey. By the way, we also included a lot of farm and ranchers in our development of the survey and testing it with them to make sure that we were addressing the issues that were most pertinent to them as well. As I said, we were out in the field and we collected our data. And I'm going to move right along because I was told I have only 20 minutes, so I'll try to keep it nice and short for all of you. But the first part of the presentation, I'm going to share with you the specific responses from Minnesota farm and ranch operators. And that constitutes 266 of the 2,000 people who responded to our survey. And just so you know, for those of you who are into statistics, that is a representative sample of your state. And one of the things that's very interesting when we look at this data is that no state is significantly different than the other states. We're pretty homogenous up here in the Great Plains and Minnesota area, Minnesota, Missouri, and Iowa. If you look, the majority of our farm and ranch operators were male, 94% in fact. Caucasian, probably not a big surprise, 99%. Two-thirds of them were married, and 83% of them were over the age of 44. Now, again, this is very consistent with what we see across the country in terms of the age of farmers and ranchers that are currently participating as full-time operators. And again, the pie chart just shows you how these age groups were distributed. We asked the question as to whether or not farming and ranching was their principal occupation, and over half said that indeed it was. However, 42% said that their principal job was off the farm or ranch, and we thought that was a pretty interesting finding. And again, that's consistent with all seven states. And this is Minnesota data. And by the way, this is a Minnesota farm from Waseca County. The income levels of farmers were also very consistent across the state. And as you can see, the majority of farmers had incomes between $40,000 and just under $100,000. And this, of course, is somewhat higher than the median household income for the average Minnesotan or the average family in these seven states. Although 32% had incomes less than $40,000, and just a very small percent, 15%, had incomes over $100,000. So again, you're looking at a population that has somewhat higher income than the average citizens in the state overall. We then asked questions about their health status. And what was surprising was that our respondents indicated they were as healthy as other respondents across the nation. 62% said that they were either in excellent or very good health. And that is consistent with a national survey conducted by the National Health Interview Survey Group. One-third said that they were in good health, and 7% said that they were in either fair or poor health. And given the physical requirements to be able to farm and ranch, it's quite likely that people that are in poor health actually exit that occupation. I'm a farm girl, so I kind of have a little background there. When we asked questions about health insurance, we found out that the vast majority, 94% of our farm and ranch operators, said that they had health insurance. Now, again, this is very consistent across all seven states. We have a higher than national average of people who have health insurance. But again, remember, their incomes are also slightly higher. And we also know that farm and ranch people, some who need operating loans, for example, we have been told anecdotally that some of them need to demonstrate that they have some kind of health insurance coverage to be able to secure farm operation loans. So that also may be contributing to that higher rate of insured. 2% of these people indicated that nobody in their family had health insurance the previous 12 months, and about 4% said that somebody in their family did not have health insurance coverage. Then we asked, where are you getting your health insurance? And over half of these people are actually getting their health insurance through their own employment off-farm or through their spouse's employment. And again, if you recall, over half of our respondents said that they are working, or 42% said that they are working off-farm as their principal place of employment. But one-third of these people purchase health insurance on that individual health insurance market. They purchase it directly for themselves. And to put that in context, when you look nationally, that's 4.5 times what the average American does in terms of purchase in the individual market. Most people in our country get their health insurance through the employer market. So when we look at this, these findings also have significance, not only for farm and ranchers, but also for other small business owners who purchase health insurance in that individual market. A very few people indicated that they had either Medicare, Medicaid, or Veterans Administration coverage. When we asked that very small percent, if you remember it was only 2%, why they did not have health insurance, 3 out of 4 indicated because the premiums are too costly. And we captured some of their comments, and one of the respondents said that costs are outrageous and all insurance is outrageous for what we put in and what we get out of it. We also asked about medical debt. Because nationally, the Commonwealth Fund has also looked into this. And our our farm and ranchers, again, with slightly higher incomes than the national or than our state averages, one out of five had some kind of medical debt, and almost half of those had medical debt that was to their primary care provider. So that would have been their health care practitioner, be it a physician, nurse practitioner, PA. Other sources of debt related to hospital care and also dental care. And what was fascinating, too, is there's a lot of folks in our survey that do not have dental coverage, but they are carrying debt, and that is also impacting their ability to be financially viable. I have a few quotes from some Minnesota respondents that I thought might help give you a flavor of some of the things that we heard directly. And I won't read all of them, but I'll just read a couple of them just to give you an idea. It said, "We just make the deductible, then the year is over, so we never really feel the benefit from having health insurance. We are paying everything at 100%. If the deductibles were lower and the cost not so high, it would benefit the farmers and ranchers." Another person shared that their spouse had to get off-farm employment so that they could obtain health insurance. And yet others comment that as the cost gets so high, they rarely use their health insurance. And they're lucky to be having good health, but what we also find in talking to folks, most people don't know how good their health insurance is until they actually need it. So if you ask anybody, you know, what are your deductibles or how good is your health insurance, usually families who have a need or have had a recent illness or injury, they know very well what is covered and what is not. But until you actually need that health insurance, you often are not aware about the kind of coverage or the limitations of your coverage. Now, these responses are based on all seven states. And this is where we ask some questions about the financial burden of care. And nearly one in four of the farm and ranch operators indicated that health insurance and health care costs contributed to financial problems. And this included issues pertaining to having to get off-farm employment, delaying making investments in farms, paying their medical bills, and also just maintaining their rent and mortgages. Then we asked, how do you pay for your health care? Well, one out of four said that they had to draw upon other resources to pay for their health care costs. Over half of them said that they are using their family savings. 10%, or 1 in 10, incurred some kind of credit card debt, and others borrowed against their home or farm or withdrew money from their retirement accounts to pay for their health care costs. We also asked questions about delaying care, because we know that if people delay care, they often delay opportunities for screenings, or they delay care to the point that they have to access more aggressive care. And 43% said that they did indeed delay health care. And of those who did delay it, 70% said that the primary reason was that they could not afford the cost of care. And of course, other reasons, coming from farm and ranch country, was because of the demands and seasonality of farm work, as well as some of these people had discomfort from already owing money to their provider and did not feel comfortable going in and accessing more health care. So where are we now? In collaboration with the Access Project, we're now developing our second brief. We have the first brief here. I think you all should have a copy of it. And if you don't, we will make sure that you do. And that kind of provides an overview of all seven states. At this point in time, we're developing a second issue brief that's going to be released in November. And that issue brief is going to really look at the value of these different health insurance products, specifically looking at the amounts of premiums, deductible, and out-of-pocket, because we're really interested in looking at that financial risk that people are placed into. And we're hoping that some of this information will also be informative as people look at consumer-driven health plan options to see how does that really operationalize, especially in an individual market where you have an aging population and if they have any kind of pre-existing conditions. And again, this is feedback that we received from the respondents. It has made it very expensive for them even to obtain a basic health care coverage. With that, I will thank you, and I don't know if you want questions at the end or...
No, thank you very much. And I think that I think we'll take some questions now if people have them. The thing that really is interesting to me after I looked at some of the research earlier is that, you know, I think that the farm and ranch families are actually a good snapshot of a lot of other small businesses, too, because it's very, I think a lot of other small businesses are kind of similarly situated. And, you know, the notion that 94% of people are covered or have access to insurance, and nonetheless we're seeing, you know, delays in getting care due to cost, people feeling, you know, a quarter of people feeling that their insurance that they have is not adequate, I think that's very telling. And so I think this actually informs our larger discussion as well, not just about farm and rural families, but our whole healthcare reform discussion going forward. So it's very helpful. But do people have specific questions about the research, Tom? Representative Huntley?
Dr. Knudsen, did you look at the amount of the deductibles that the farmers would have, at least those that they were buying their own and weren't getting it through employment elsewhere?
Representative Huntley, yes, we did look at those, and that is what is going to be coming out in our second brief. So you can see what kind of financial risk people are given the types of products that they're purchasing. Because what we found as a preliminary view of what's going to be coming is that it isn't always that the lowest premium product has the highest deductible.
Yeah, Representative Emmer.
Thank you. First, I didn't see the survey. Do we have a copy of the survey or the questions, the actual questions?
No, but I'd be happy to get that for you.
I would love to see that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested to know the if you do the math out of the states that you looked at, did you have some minimum requirements as to what you believe qualified as a farm for purposes of identifying farm operators?
Absolutely. We use the same way that the USDA, the National Statistical Agricultural Services, uses the farm criteria or their the way that they measure and gather data. One of the reasons we partnered with them is because they actually conduct these kinds of surveys on an annual, usually semi-annual basis, where they look at planting information and then harvest information. And so they have basically the universe of everybody who is operating a farm. The one thing that we did exclude from our survey was any corporate farm entity.
I guess if I can follow.
Yes, absolutely.
That's where I was going, is I'm not familiar with if there's a minimum acreage requirement for purposes of the federal standard, and you're excluding corporate farms. I'd like to know, are we talking about farms that could go as low as 10 acres or 20 acres, and what type of farm are we talking about in terms of what they're producing? Because I guess I tend to have some concerns about trying to compare farm operations to other independent businesses when we actually have laws specifically designed for farm corporations that are run by families, and they get many different tax benefits that other independent businesses wouldn't get. And I want to know if you have something that I can look at to see, did you go down to 10 acres, and was it one person who's milking six cows? Or I want to get an idea for what you used.
You know, I need to have the USDA get that information. I'll get that from them to get to give it to you, because I'm not clear on what their criteria is. We use the criteria that they use when they do their annual surveys of farm and ranch operators.
Thank you very much.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Dr. Knudsen. I have a question. On page 6, there was a slide that said 3 out of 4 uninsured farmers said that premiums were too expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of a subjective comment. A lot of things are, you know, I may think are expensive that may or may not be expensive. I guess my question is, did you do any sort of calculation to figure out what an average farm family would pay as a total percentage of their income?
That is coming in our next brief.
Oh.
You're ahead of the game.
Thanks.
Do we know yet, or you haven't done the analysis yet?
That part of the analysis hasn't been completed yet.
Okay. Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Chair. And Dr. Knutson, again, it may be in the next brief, but this issue in terms of the issues raised, a large portion of this group relative to the nation is in the self-insured, you know, private market. And the second, document here, it's even higher than what you reported. It's 36% is in a direct purchase, and the employment link has gone down. In terms of two of the things you pointed out, level of medical debt and also delayed care, did you do any analysis to determine how that was linked to the three primary sources of insurance, the direct purchase, off-farm, or public programs?
You know, you are all previewing our next briefs that are coming out. Those are exactly the things that we're looking at to help spell out how those all impact each other.
We look forward to it.
Seeing the 94% have insurance, even though many of them had to go out to the private market, that's one of the highest coverage rates I've seen for any group. And I wondered if you've ever seen comparable data for other independent business owners. I just didn't know if that was higher than most independent businesses or about the same. I really don't know, but I'm wondering.
You know, we haven't. I'll tell you, one of the challenges that we've been looking to do is trying to do some small business surveys, but it's really difficult to get a sample of who is that small business owner. And so if you all have any ideas within your state, I know the Access Project is working with some folks in Iowa trying to get their arms around some of those issues pertaining to who is that small business so we can get some comparative information.
Representative Dean. Thank you, Mr. Did you look at all at, this is the supply of health insurance as that portion of access.
Mm-hmm.
In order, if you have all the health insurance in the world, it doesn't do any good unless there's a provider there to provide those services, particularly in critical access areas. We see decreasing specialists, dentists, anesthesiologists, OB. Did you look at the supply or perhaps the delay in seeing a provider as what is the access? Is there anybody to go to, even if, whether you do or you don't have insurance?
That was part of that was one of the responses that they could have given, and there was a small fraction of people who did identify, you know, access to appropriate providers. You know, one of the challenges that I think all the states have in common, not just Minnesota or not just North Dakota, is this issue of access to dental care and to mental health. Those two are our biggest challenges in terms of providing access, especially in rural communities.
And I think that our next presenter is going to get at that issue a little bit as well, but that's a good question. Well, why don't we go there, and then as we finish up the next discussion, we can ask some more questions. Thank you very much. The next presenter is Mark Schoenbaum from the Department of Health, right? The Office of Rural Health and Primary Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you. And again, thanks again for the invitation. It's great to be here. It was great to tour the hospital this afternoon. It's a very impressive facility. And you do have a handout on this as well. I've had the opportunity to present to some of you, some of the members of this committee are on other committees, just recently, and some of what I'll be talking about you have seen before. Some of it will be new. Again, we're the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care. Our mission is to maintain and improve access for Minnesotans in rural and underserved urban areas. And one of the important ways we do that is we work in partnership with a governor-appointed advisory committee, which has a new report out, which was just released. You have it in your handouts or on the back table, that I think ties right into the presentation we just saw. A report of the state's Rural Health Advisory Committee. Again, the committee has 15 members appointed by the governor, composed of providers, consumers, and higher education, at this point a representative from the medical school in Duluth, and four legislators. And this committee advises the commissioner and other state agencies on rural health issues. As you'll see in the report, you'll see the names of the members of the committee in the report. You'll also see the names of the members of the work group that they convened last summer with health care reform under broad discussion in Minnesota and nationally. The Rural Health Advisory Committee thought it was important to look at health reform from a rural perspective, and that's what the report you have in front of you represents. They began by looking at what makes rural different. What are the characteristics of rural Minnesota? You can see the short list on this slide here as well. Rural Minnesota has 80% of the land area in the state, and depending on how you define rural, 30 to 40% of the population. And there are differences among the rural population. It generally tends to be older, although that's not true in every area. There are income differences, health status differences. For instance, there's greater tooth loss in rural areas, greater childhood obesity, and most of our automobile fatalities take place in rural areas. There are also differences in health coverage, which we'll be talking about more. And there's growing diversity in rural Minnesota. All that leads, combined with a great land area, to issues of distance. And those of us that drove up from the Twin Cities today, I was kind of thinking as I was, certainly after I left Cloquet, what would happen if the car crashed here? In the middle of a distance a long way from someone else. So those are issues that are at play in rural Minnesota. All of these give the rural health care delivery system challenges, both in terms of its workforce and in terms of the financial stability and the infrastructure, buildings, equipment, technology required to deliver modern health care. The good news, and we saw a lot of this today the hospital, is that there is a long, long history of creativity and innovation. And you've got a lot of that at work right here in Hibbing and in the surrounding area. Some people think that rural health, because it's small communities, fewer people, must be simple. That's far from the case. There's a wide variety of rural health facilities, and there's a wide variety of ownership and size, small, medium, and large. In Hibbing, I think you're kind of on the large end of rural, and also different ownership types and institutional arrangements. The economic differences that we find in rural Minnesota and rural America lead to some of the findings that, that were found in the research that we just heard reported. Rural employment is disproportionately low wage, higher proportion of part-time jobs, and seasonal jobs. The survey that we saw was about farm and ranch operators. And you know, there's not as many of those on the range as there are in other parts of Minnesota. But the point was already made about the similarities with other small businesses. And the one that occurs to me in this part of the state is logging and forestry, which I believe would have some of the same characteristics. With the type of employment and with the predominance of small business, employer-sponsored policies are less common in rural Minnesota, and individually purchased policies are much more common, often with the same types of characteristics that we heard about a moment ago. Another characteristic of the rural economy and rural health care is that in many communities, and we heard this again this afternoon, healthcare is the biggest sector of a community and of the rural economy in many areas. It's not uncommon for healthcare to be the biggest employer, and more than 20% of the jobs often come from healthcare in a given community or area. So the work group and the Rural Health Advisory Committee looked at these characteristics of rural Minnesota. And with health reform in mind, they developed a series of recommendations that you find in the report. Knowing that healthcare is under discussion at the state capitol in a number of forums, the recommendations were organized to mirror the themes that one of the health reform groups. The Health Transformation Task Force is looking at this summer and fall. And here you can see kind of a quick summary of the categories of recommendations that are detailed in the report. I think I will be talking about most of them in a little more detail, but let me draw your attention for a moment to the last point there about building on the strengths of the rural system. Something that I was struck by this afternoon at the hospital, and again, a rural hospital is always more than a hospital. We were at the campus this afternoon, and we saw how the co-location of hospital, clinic, home care, in some communities, many communities, nursing home, and other health providers and health facilities can present opportunities for quality improvement, for patient management, for the medical home concept, and for economic efficiencies as well. In the coverage category, the advisory committee and the report you have in front of you adopted what I was frankly surprised to see. Their overriding theme regarding health coverage needs in rural Minnesota is to work towards universal coverage. And they didn't come at this from any philosophical angle. As you can see the details on this slide, taking a look at all of the challenges facing rural Minnesota and rural America, and looking back at the attempts that there have been to address these challenges piecemeal, and those attempts, despite good intentions, have not gotten very far, they were left with the conclusion that working towards universal coverage is what it's going to take to provide the goals that they are after and many others are as well. However, in the meantime, they did have some specific recommendations. And you can see them there. Building on previous pilot projects, some trying to respond to some of the natural challenges working with individuals and small groups in the insurance market, some related to the unique characteristics of farmers who, though income poor and may be eligible on an income basis for Minnesota Care, are often excluded because of the value of the farmland that they hold. We may want to come back to some of the coverage recommendations, but moving along here in the interest of time, technology is part of the quality that we all expect in healthcare today. And they have some recommendations along those lines. We'll be talking about the health provider workforce in a while, but the technology workforce is also a challenge, and particularly as we move towards electronic health records and other innovations, some of, again, which we saw at the campus this afternoon. There are models out there. One of them in this part of the state, out of Duluth, is called SISU, which those of you that are Finnish may know that word, which is a regional technology support organization serving many of the small hospitals in northeastern Minnesota. Let's move on to workforce. They have a series of recommendations related to workforce. Here's the workforce statewide. And as you can see, nurses are the biggest part of that workforce, approximately 50,000 nurses. Physicians, there's approximately 12,500. Keep those figures in mind as we move along. Grouped together, allied health, lab techs, radiology techs, a wide variety, physical therapy, occupational therapy are also needed, and a large workforce now and challenges for the future. As with any resource, the health workforce is not distributed evenly. And I'm sure these slides are too small to see, but they are a depiction of where there are health workforce shortages in Minnesota. In a regional center like Hibbing, according to the federal definition of shortage, there is actually not a shortage of physicians. But as mentioned earlier, there is a clear shortage of mental health providers and of dentists. The first line of providing health care is the primary care provider, whether it's physician, advanced practice nurse, or physician assistant. And here again, looking at the distribution of this part of the workforce, we can see that there are relatively fewer primary care physicians in rural areas. A word about that middle bar there, micropolitan. Micropolitan is a new federal term for larger rural areas. So it's still a rural area. It's a rural area with a population between 10,000 and 50,000. But the bottom two bars are what make up rural areas. The difference in the distribution of primary care physicians really plays out when we look at their distribution this way. So let's just look at the right graphic for a moment here. So of the rural physician workforce, almost 80% of it is composed of primary care physicians. So they're a smaller share of the state's physicians, but a much greater share of rural Minnesota's physicians. And they're getting older. And when we look at the nursing workforce, we see a similar age characteristics. And when we go on to ask nurses, and we've asked this question of other providers, what are your plans? We find that almost 40% of them do not plan to be working as nurses after the next 10 years. So something's going on here. When we talk about changes to healthcare opportunities for the medical home, opportunities to stretch our primary care providers, we often think of nurse practitioners and physician assistants. We also heard about the importance of nurse anesthetists at the hospital today. They are clearly important. When we put them in the context, again, of 12,500 physicians and 50,000 nurses, they're perhaps not as big a part of the workforce as we might have thought. And if we were to look at other health occupations, we'd find similar characteristics. So what do we do about all this? And again, a lot of this is going on right here in Hibbing and in northeastern Minnesota. This is what's commonly called the workforce development pipeline. I've termed it here the healthcare safety net pipeline. It applies to our rural health workforce and our safety net Twin Cities workforce as well. And it starts with preparing kids and attracting them into health occupations. And we heard this afternoon how the hospital is involved in that. Once they're interested, we've got to get them into training. We've got to train them to work where they're going to be needed, and so that they get exposure to the benefits and the satisfactions of working in those needed areas. Once they come out of training, they're going to have lots of options. So we need to figure out ways to get them in to high need settings. And once they're there, we need to keep them there. So given the shortages that are out there, through this model, we know that we can increase production, and we need to do so. I won't spend a lot of time going over examples other than to say that we at the health department are involved, the university is involved, Minsky is involved, health facilities themselves are involved, and there's a good example of that here. And in this part of the state, the IRRRB actually contributes to health workforce development and has made a difference. You've also got some ideas about new things we can try to do better at this. I think one promising development, we haven't seen a lot of it yet in rural Minnesota, but we do see it in the Twin Cities, is the development of magnet schools and charter schools, mainly high schools, to expose kids and prepare them for health careers. I think that has a lot of promise. On to recruiting. There are some activities going on here now. And there are a number of new things to try. Technology has a role here. There are conversations out there that we're not, particularly from a rural health standpoint and a primary care standpoint. The medical school admissions process isn't doing as good a job as it could of attracting and admitting people who would be both suited and interested in working in primary care and in high-need areas. So there may be some changes that we can make there. Training programs need to be located in rural and other high-need areas. And again, we saw some of that going on right here in Hibbing. Some of the barriers that we see there are that there is a shortage, a bottleneck, a shortage of faculty, mainly in nursing and in other other health occupations, that is limiting the number of new grads that our health institute, our educational institutions can produce. And we're also seeing, given the demands on our healthcare providers these days, that we don't have as many clinical sites to give people that real-world experience while they're in training as we would like. So some attention could be paid there. We can influence where people work. I won't spend a lot of time on this. One development of note is that here in Hibbing, and I walked by their office at the hospital, you have an Area Health Education Center, which is a nonprofit organization with a community board under the auspices of the University of Minnesota, whose job it is to make that workforce development pipeline produce for your region. And there are area health education centers throughout the state. They're fairly new. They have a lot of potential. And again, retaining people once they're there. There's a role both for incentives. Loan forgiveness has a retention effect. People that have a good experience earlier in their career tend to stay where they begin. And community efforts are also key. We didn't talk about this today, this afternoon, at the hospital, but I assume in this community there are also efforts to make your health workers feel a part of the community, make sure their family, their children are also interested in staying where the provider is working. Retaining older nurses. You saw the age curve. The longer we can keep people in the workforce, the better off we'll be. So we need to do everything we can, but it's not going to solve the problem. There are fewer and fewer medical students going into primary care specialties for a variety of reasons. There may be some dispute about the reasons, but the phenomenon is not in dispute. This dark bar here, you can see, are the number of family practice residents. And you can see that it peaked in 1997, has fallen off since then, and has fallen off more since the data on this chart. Putting all this together, it gets really scary. This is, chart's a little busy, but it's percents on the left-hand side of the chart. Can you see it? I'm in the way. Given the aged nature of our current workforce, they're going to be leaving. And how fast they're going to be leaving is represented by those lines that are going into the negative below zero there. Our educational institutions, while here and there are producing a few more graduates than in the past, are not producing that many more, and the production of new graduates is basically flat. And while all this is happening, the baby boom is hitting 60 and 65. Their chronic conditions are going to be catching up with them. Older people use more health care. We've got a problem. One that we cannot train ourselves out of, probably. So what do you do? What do we do as a society? Well, we have to start looking at doing things different. And those of the representatives on this committee and others are asking themselves just this question about how do we redesign healthcare work, healthcare jobs, and how we deliver healthcare to make our resources stretch farther. Again, we've got ambitious goals. Make our resources stretch farther, reduce costs, improve quality. How do we do it? One way is to do some tinkering with who does what kind of work in healthcare. This gets to be a very controversial topic. I'm not going to spend a lot of time going into it, but there are probably licensing and other opportunities to use people better to do what they are most highly trained for and bring new entrants in kind of in some of these lower skilled but just as important areas to stretch the resources available. One exciting example that I want to point you to is in the lower right corner of this chart. One concept that is being talked about is to provide our paramedics and EMTs with additional training so that they could become part of the healthcare team when they're not out on ambulance runs. And in rural areas, ambulance runs are not as frequent as they are in high-density areas, and I think there's a lot of potential here. Again, I mentioned this gets controversial very quickly. Here are some of the factors that get into those conversations. In the interest of time, I'm not going to pause on them. But it does take a lot of things happening together to make those kinds of changes. Here are some things going on. And again, we do see some of this innovation in rural hospitals. Small rural hospitals, critical access hospitals, many are called, do have the flexibility to use advanced practice nurses and physician assistants more independently in the hospital and in the emergency room. And that's a model that I think might bear a broader look. There's a bullet here called medication therapy management, which kind of could be shorthand for involving the pharmacist more closely as a member of the healthcare team. There's a wide range of examples, and I think there are many of you are at least as expert as I am at those, and are you're looking at them as we speak. Again, you know, it's always good to get out, and I think we were all pretty impressed this afternoon hearing about the thoughtful approach to prevention and chronic disease management going on here in Hibbing. Something else, you know, I want to give you things to think about today. This is an article from Missouri. And the headline, not sure you can read it, says, Nurse-Owned Clinics Replace Country Doctors. This is in some ways the development of what some of us may know as the Minute Clinic concept to more sparsely populated rural areas. Again, more mainly by necessity, but it is something that may be part of the mix. I want to close by kind of first recommending the full report to you. It touches the topics that I've mentioned and a number of others. But I want to close by talking about the Institute of Medicine's, which is a federal, at least national, kind of think tank of wise people that thinks about healthcare, chartered by Congress under, I believe, the National Academies of Sciences. They began to take a look at healthcare quality and medical errors a number of years ago in the late 90s. And they are, I think, who we have to thank for putting the changes that we hear about for healthcare safety improvements, like marking surgery sites. They're the ones that put that into the news. A couple of years after that, they took a look at the rural healthcare system and asked the same question. If we want to improve safety, improve quality, reduce errors in the rural healthcare system, what's the strategy? And they came up with a strategy that I think, again, at first look may be surprising, but ties back to many of the things we've been talking about. They said it takes more than a focus on preventing errors within the healthcare system by the clinician. That's their point two here, which is what you might expect, establish a stronger quality improvement structure. They said when you're looking at rural America, given all the characteristics and many of the things we've talked about tonight, you need to look much broader. You need to look at the community. You need to encourage individuals to take responsibility for their own health. You need to look at workforce. You need to make sure that the system has the financial resources to keep the doors open, and you need to invest in technology and information systems. With that, I will close. We've taken, I think, a tour from looking at some coverage issues and some work in Minnesota by some healthcare leaders to scoping out to the national level, and it all seems to connect up. There's a lot of work ahead, both challenges and opportunities. I want to thank the committee again for your time, and turn it back to you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any questions from the members on the report at this point? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I'm looking at the slide that deals with the, what I look at sort of like overlapping scopes, the examining healthcare jobs. And, you know, we authorized reimbursement for community health workers in the last session, which is sort of a generalized a healthcare worker that would do advocacy and health education for people in communities. And so I see these other categories, and I'm wondering what would differentiate like a community health worker from a community dental worker, because it is a fairly generalized educational preparation. So I'm just wondering if you have a little more info on those other two categories for me.
The community dental worker is a concept that I've just heard about recently. And my understanding is it would have more clinical responsibilities, more kind of direct care responsibilities than the community health worker. You know, there are also opportunities within the current scope of practice structure within dentistry that could be more widely used, among dental hygienists and dentists. But again, all those other agreements and factors, you know, need to come together to realize that potential. The community paramedic would also have some direct clinical ingredients in their scope of practice. Immunizations, basic exams. They would also do community wellness and health prevention, similar to the community health worker. I've got kind of a list of some of the early thinking on what all those clinical components might be, which I'd be happy to get you.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And then one much more general question. When you talk about a primary care provider, who do you put in that basket? When you think about the both licensed or unlicensed providers now involved in health care delivery, Do you sort of sort through them and think this is the cadre of primary care providers?
Subject area-wise, the standard list that comes to mind are family practice, general internal medicine, sometimes OB, always psychiatry.
Physician.
So those subject areas, kind of regardless of who is delivering them.
Going back to the coverage piece of this, discussion, and you, there are two of the items that you highlight. One is related to the affordability of commercial insurance, and the other has to do with state participation in reinsurance strategies. And particularly in that affordability discussion, and related to the first presentation, you know, even with people that have the insurance, there's an issue with affordability. Can you talk a little bit more detail about what you found or what the recommendations would be in that area?
The recommendation is based on the same kinds of questions you were asking, and I too am waiting for the next in the series from the Farm and Ranch study. But it is based on at least the experience of the people involved in developing the report, who were had some deep experience working on rural insurance issues and coverage issues, that between premiums, sometimes premiums themselves, the cost of the premium is a major barrier. And we heard stories about premiums of $10,000 with $10,000 deductibles and pre-existing conditions excluded. Mm-hmm. So those are the at least the anecdotes driving that recommendation, and I think we'll all be interested to hear what comes out of this Midwest study.
And what can you talk a little bit about the insurance market? The health insurance market itself, in terms of who is out there, what's available?
I'm going to get beyond my expertise very quickly here, but I will talk for a moment about what led to this reinsurance recommendation. And there has been prior state law on that, and Representative Huntley probably is better able to speak to this than I am. A common phenomenon that's a challenge that's, that those working to come up with small group options have run into is the, again, the cost and, again, just the spiral that takes place when sicker people remain in a pool and healthier people drop out. And reinsurance, basically buying an insurance policy or setting aside direct funds to cover insurance payments, if you will, above a certain level, has been tried as a strategy to mediate that phenomenon. And I don't know if you want to comment on its success, Representative Huntley. It has not solved the problem, but again, short of a universal solution, the members of, you know, involved in this process thought some of these things, you know, we need to keep at them.
Representative Loughlin.
Can you address whether the Minsku campuses have been working throughout the state in terms of helping build career ladders and that continuing ed opportunities, so that people here who might start out as, you know, the nursing aide and then move, can get training and become a certified nursing assistant and then maybe get into an LPN program? I mean, are those working? Is the scheduling, the financing of it helping us, you know, sort of grow that rural workforce that's close to a Minsku campus at least, or district or distance learning?
I can't speak to that. In specific, I know that Minsku has some new activities around career ladder, but I don't know if there's anybody from Minsku here. But I can't speak to the effectiveness of it.
Some metropolitan hospitals that have had real workforce shortage issues as well have found that to be a real effective investment in their workforce, and it actually helps you with turnover issues and retention if people kind of can see a way up to a better standard of living within that institution.
I'd agree. Those are those examples within healthcare institutions are the biggest successes that I'm aware of.
Mm-hmm. Representative Dean.
Did you look at all at access to healthcare providers, EMTs, and physicians outstate with respect to access to liability insurance for EMT providers or physicians from the rising costs in order to get that insurance from the extremely predatory trial lawyers that
I don't have systematic information on that, Representative Dean, but I will tell you the place where we hear it most is regarding OB. And OB access to OB services in smaller communities with smaller hospitals that don't have a lot of deliveries a year, both from a, I think, at least as much from a risk management standpoint as an insurance standpoint. I think most people kind of pull the plug because of their institutional concerns before they're priced out of the liability market. That's what I hear anecdotally.
Representative Pepper.
Mr. Schoenbaum, I have a question for you on the Rural Advisory Committee itself. And I see that you mentioned it was appointed by the governor, and I'm wondering what the parameters were for who was chosen on the task force, maybe the timeline of when the findings took place. And I'm wondering if there, I'm looking at the list, and it seems like there are a lot of folks affiliated with medical centers and hospitals. And I'm wondering, since there's a lot of discussion about what small businesses need for their employees, did you have any, on the committee, was there anybody from a representative from small business, say the Federation of Independent Business, or what, because it seems rather sided to the medical side, but not to the employment side. And I'm just wondering how these folks were picked by the governor. Was that under legislation that defined what types of people that would have to be picked, or was it random? Or if you could
Mr.
just
Chairman.
Talk a little bit more about the
Representative Pepin, that's in statute. The membership categories are in statute. They are, I tried not to put them all on the slide to save a little time here, but let me see if I can tick through them. Physician, nurse, mid-level provider, hospital, volunteer ambulance representative, four consumers, that's up to nine, four legislators, representative of a rural higher education institution. Small business is not specified. I believe we have had some over the years. And we've also had dentists, and we've had an optometrist who's both a healthcare provider and small business person.
Could you provide the statute and when that was put in statute? I know you probably don't have it with you, but
I can get you the site. It's been in statute since the early 90s.
Early 90s, okay. And then on this list, I'm just wondering, the consumers, are they, which ones they are? Is that, there's a couple names. I'm wondering if you could just go over a couple of them. Are they the ones that don't have affiliations listed?
They are. John Berg is a county commissioner from Watonwan County. Deborah Carpenter is from North Central Minnesota. Levon Schliemann is a retired woman from Morris. And who am I missing? Must be missing somebody, but anyway, that's three of them.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. This has been very helpful. We can think about it overnight and maybe have some more questions tomorrow as well.
That's no fun.
Our next, we have a couple of folks I think that are going to give us a little bit of a more local taste here. Larry, Bob, is he here still? Yes, in the back. If you could, do you want to, what do we do here? Just, do we have a microphone? Use the same one?
Yeah.
to say anything.
You got to get a pedestal.
It's if you have any reactions. Or
you don't have to.
You don't have to.
I think most of you were at the hospital this afternoon. Again, we're very encouraged by the fact that you would take the time to visit our facility and afford the people here the opportunity for questions and observations. I'm not going to expound on what I said at the hospital. I just think that this is an extremely complex issue about access and cost that you're dealing with, and the temptation to look solely at a universal insurance package is certainly necessary, that one. But at the same time, I think that that chronic care management is where the bang for the bucks is. And I don't think you can legislate that, but I think you can incent people to take better care and more responsibility for their health. The only comment I wanted to make, and I'm in the way. If you don't mind, I'll just talk about it.
Yes.
Take the thing.
Can I just ask, in terms of your budgets going forward, and I don't know if you can share this or not, but capital, what kind of percentage numbers are we talking about to really move in that direction?
Probably in IS, we're talking about all over here, we're probably up to 17%. But Lila, I'll use as an example because it's up here, has spent about $690 million so far in medical revenue. Keeping in mind that that is not a patient. A revenue producing thing necessarily. So it's all passed off to hospitals and patients. I would guess that it's a piecemeal thing, as you can know, but at our hospital here in Cleveland, we're probably looking at several $1 million to get at least to a generational stage that we can then continue to develop in the relationships with Adams and Clinton. It's the government, the president, as you know, has mandated it. And then, of course, not funded. But it's a very serious thing, and I suppose I can sound administrative if I would say that we won't be paid. You know, the rural hospital will stop being paid in most of their procedures because insurance companies do not want people to want a digital exchange. And so it's what keeps me away from NICE because I'm not quite sure our hospital is going to be able to automatically come up with the money that it will be passed off at the expense of other
users.
There's
questions.
There's another question. Representative Loeffler.
Oh, well, I was just going to ask to that point, have we gotten to the point of a common enough platform So that, I mean, I know there's been action at the federal level to try and develop a common platform so that if you're a patient up here when you're at your lake cabin and then you go home to someplace else, you know, that there's some dialogue as well. And I'm a little concerned about us, about your system, other systems, all putting in huge amounts of money. And you talked about the medical arms race. You buy, you know, software package A, Hibbing, you know, at Hibbing. Virginia buys, you know, software package C, you know, and the Grand Rapids goes with a different vendor. And so that even within a region, a relatively close geographic area, the communication isn't going to work. It'll work between your clinic and the doctor's office, but maybe not someone down the road. And I don't know where we're at or if you need public leadership on that process, even at the state level.
Kind of dicey because the competitors would probably love some conclusion that would happen in the Epic, for instance, in the state or Meditech. The answer is we have, and there's two things happen. Number one, we realize we don't make any better decision unless we know we can build a bridge. That's relatively inexpensive. And number two, the vendors are coming through generations of progress where they'll talk between them. My own suspicion is that was intentional to start with, and it's very unfortunate because it's very inexpensive. I think that, you know, you want to order a camera, you're going to have to buy this film and stuff, and then somebody else went this way. And now they're finding that exactly what you said. Everybody has went through the casting very expensive decision points, and you can't turn back. Mm-hmm. You've got to find a bridge.
I just want to respond to that question also, because as you know,
we should probably just do it, even though it's probably barely getting picked up. Identify yourself.
Well, thank you. Services. Thank you. I just want to respond to that because your question is right on, and that it's unfortunate that we're right across the street, basically, from Pendleton County Medical Center with the University of Minnesota Hospital, and even Abbott Northwestern, our competitor, and we can't talk to one another. And we're trying to break down that barrier. We recently have all signed an agreement to try and figure out how to do that. To go back to your question, Representative Teason, we have a new position, he's our IS person within here in corporate, and he told me it was going to be between $250 and $500 million to, just for Fairview to start talking about that. So it's so easy to put it on paper that we have to put the IS together. And I asked him, Ray, why is this so difficult? He goes, because each procedure is a different complication. It's not like a bank transaction that is just one simple procedure. Every time you do something, it is another transaction within that component. So it's going to take a while. And I think we really do have to figure out, to Representative Lockler's question, how we don't disengage in how we use the software. And that's a really important point as you guys go forward. I'd like to also go back to the question that you asked about workforce and just tell you from another perspective, just to finish the loop on that piece. I feel really blessed that we have a wonderful working relationship with Minsky and up here and across the system. In fact, Laura Beeb is our director of workforce within Fairview, and she's the chair of the group. I think Representative Huffman, you've met with her before. We found that we've had a great opportunity to bring folks that are nursing assistants and taking them to nurses. In fact, I know Alina, I know Mayo, I know Fairview puts forth quite a bit of money to help people go to the next level. But as one of our staff people pointed out, the waiting list up here in the nursing program is 2 years, and it's due to faculty. It's very similar to the problem that we have in medical school, is we've got to get the folks in there to actually be able to teach. And how can we encourage that? Unfortunately, so much we've done in the state of the world. Thank you.
Okay. We also have Dr. Jerry Peterson, I think, here, who's a dentist, and I think we'll, I believe that's the case.
Yes.
Well, that's great. And it'll, there, which raises obviously, as we, I think everybody here knows, some unique challenges, so I think this will be very helpful. Thank you for coming.
I do have a very quick presentation. I was told yesterday I could have 5 minutes, and then Jen emailed me and said I can't.
Sure.
So I didn't think, I need to start as a handout statement. I apologize for that. I just finished this about 10 minutes of time.
I've got to touch this one.
I want to thank Jen McNerney for inviting me tonight, but I also want to thank the panel in advance for listening to me tonight. Now, as I said, I didn't bring a handout, so people will have to turn and look at the screen. I am a dentist. I practice dentistry for 31 years now. I work for the University of Minnesota now, and I work at the Hibbing Community College Dental Clinic. Hibbing Community College Dental Clinic, of course, is affiliated with the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry, and we have four dental students that come up to Hibbing year-round, not four-week rotations year-round, and we run a little clinic right here in town. And it does, we are also affiliated with Minsky because we work within a Minsky facility, so we have an agreement with Minsky to be there, even though we're the university. And there was a question here about Minsky and whether or not, you know, education progresses. And it does quite well sometimes in different programs. An example would be the dental assisting program in Hibbing, actually preparing students to get ready to go down to Lake Superior College in Duluth to become hygienists. So, we could talk for hours about dental access issues. Okay. One of the reasons Hibbing is here, and this is a picture of the clinic, and you're going to see that these are three female dentists or students that I have with me. One of the reasons Hibbing is here is it was a wonderful opportunity when the college was built in Hibbing.
Dr. Peterson, could you lift it up just a little bit?
Yes. It was a wonderful opportunity when the college was being built in Hibbing to have the dental school come in too and share a facility or share a clinic. And one of the primary goals we have here is to bring these young students out and give them a taste of rural Minnesota in hopes that they will hopefully locate in rural Minnesota, because rural Minnesota really does have a shortage of dentists. Since inception, 2002, Hibbing Clinic has, the northeastern Minnesota has actually received 15 dentists, 12 of which came through my program, and three of which came through other programs. The other side of the clinic, of course, is a dental assisting clinic. We're going to talk a little bit about need and access and recruitment tonight, if that's okay. The greatest need in dentistry is with state program patient population. These are the people that do not have access to dentistry. Little profile of our clinic that I took off our computer today, it shows you quickly just ages and percentages of patients that we see. And we can kind of group them, 0 to 19, about 30%, 20 to 39, about the next 30%, and above 40, 30%. Of our active patients, 42, 26, 71% are state program patients. So we really do provide a niche right here in Hibbing for these people to have access to dentistry. Of course, a large percentage of our patients are kids. And we have fun with them. Here's one of my students, and this young lady actually went into pediatric dentistry as a career. And the other large percentage of our patients are disabled. Okay, there's a reason that people are on medical assistance or welfare. It can be a physical handicap such as this. It can be a mental handicap. The need is great. If we look at pictures of the need, and these are pictures of all state program patients that we've seen in Hibbing. Here's a little girl. This is a three-year-old, and you can see the cavities in the front teeth. And we can go from that to this very simply, and we see this all the time. We go from that to a young girl who came into the clinic, and if everybody can see that, the nerve is exposed on that tooth. That hurts. That's how she came in. To soda pop issues with young adults. This is what soda pop does. And just neglect. Poor dental aptitude. The patient just didn't know how to take care of themselves. To, of course, drug problems. This is meth mouth. Everybody needs to see these pictures because these pictures are in rural Minnesota. Recruitment problems. So definitely there's a need. Recruitment problems. Rural Minnesota communities will need to start recruiting new dentists now. Okay, that is actually an understatement. As we've heard previously, we know there's a shortage of dentists in rural Minnesota. We also know that we have a distribution problem. State. In other words, how do we bring our young graduates out into rural Minnesota to practice dentistry? It seems like most of our young graduates want to locate in the metropolitan area. And there's many reasons for that. It can be as simple as just a spousal job. If we look at manpower right here, is there a shortage on the range? Yes. Rural Minnesota, yes. What can be done? Let's kind of look at that. Dental practitioners, Minnesota has experienced a net loss of dentists per populace as the state population has increased. Right now in Minnesota, we have about 2,900 practicing dentists. And those are the dentists who actually practice in the state. We actually have 3,400 to 3,500 licensed in the state, but many practice in Wisconsin, North, South Dakota. If we look at the range, out of 74 dentists on the range, 72% or 53 are over the age of 50. Of these dentists, 15% or 8 are of retirement age, but they're still practicing. I'm sure Representative Sertich knows that just in Virginia, we had another dentist retire and no one to replace him. Okay, so that's three dentists out of the city of Virginia that haven't been replaced. So it's becoming critical for everybody. And excuse me. There we go. Thank you so much, Tony. Attracting new dentists. What do? Well, through the sale and promotion of existing dental practices, community involvement, and I think this is going to become bigger and bigger. We need to have communities involved in trying to attract young people and young practitioners to rural Minnesota, and possibly through loan forgiveness to graduating dentists.
What do you mean exactly by community involvement?
Well, I think communities need to advertise. The dental school every year puts on a little thing that we invite practitioners come to and to showcase their practices. I think communities need to showcase their communities. I really do. And maybe it will come to the point where communities may have to pitch in just a little bit to help attract a young professional to town, especially a dentist. You know, maybe there's an old building downtown that's been empty for several years, and they could help the dentist remodel that and get somebody into that building and start a practice. I mean, it could be as simple as that. And if there are any questions, please just ask. Issues that limit access, and I have to apologize here because I've lost a slide or two here along the way pushing the buttons. But access is another issue, and one of the things that we find is that for the average fee-for-service patient, access has been good in the range anyway. I'm not saying it's good all the way across rural Minnesota, because there is one county in Minnesota that has only one dentist per 5,000 people, okay, so which is very poor. So it's hard to access a dentist. They have to travel outside the county to access a dentist. But for state programs right now, access to dental care is almost non-existent, it's very poor to almost non-existent, and that's where the Hibbing Clinic fills such a niche here. What are some of the issues to access? One, aging dental practitioners, and of course the low reimbursement rates for state programs. As we look at aging practitioners, I think one thing that people have to realize, with the average age of rural dentists increasing, their productivity is decreasing. Okay, we find that a lot of older dentists don't work full work weeks or 5 days a week. They're working 4 days a week or maybe even 3 days a week. And rural Minnesota has experienced a net loss of dentists due to retirement. As I said, three in Virginia alone just in the last few years. Okay, thank you. And state program reimbursement levels. I think it's time that we do talk about these. State program reimburse the dentist at approximately 30% of their fee. The last 62% is not collectible due to state statute. Most dentists have overhead expenditures of 65 to 70%. So it is an important point. Increasing access to dental care, a critical solution in rural Minnesota. lobbying legislators to increase reimbursement for state programs to dental practitioners, supporting community dental clinics through state aid, adding dental benefits to state programs that will make a difference. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that we really need to look at. And attracting new dentists to rural areas through innovative community ideas and loan forgiveness to recent graduates that work in rural areas. So that, in a nutshell, is my little spiel, and I want to thank you again, but are there any questions that I could possibly answer?
Questions? That statistic about 60-65% being overhead, mm-hmm. where does that come from?
Well, that's actually a statistic that has been generated through the MDA, okay? When a young dentist comes out of school, of course, buying into an office or even establishing an office is very, very expensive overhead, and it includes the overhead for that, your loan on the business itself.
And the statute that we're talking about, the reimbursement rate is set in statute?
I don't know if the reimbursement rate for dentistry for state programs is set in statute. I believe that's
the concern is state statute doesn't allow you to
you cannot collect what the state doesn't pay, no.
So the 38% comes from, where does that happen?
That comes from the MDA, Minnesota Dental Association.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Dr. Peterson. Is there an equal shortage or a similar shortage of hygienists and assistants? And, you know, in the earlier presentation, we heard about the possibility of, you know, increasing the use of paraprofessionals in all sectors of the health industry. Could you address that?
That is a wonderful question, actually. Right now, if you look at northeastern Minnesota, we don't have a shortage of hygienists because we have a school in Duluth. Okay, so in other parts of the state, there is a shortage of hygienists. So if you go out to the northwestern part of the state, you're going to find that there's a shortage of hygienists out there. And a few years ago, people were looking for hygienists even here, but now we seem to have overproduced them, at least in this part of the state. I can't speak for all parts of the state. Could you repeat that last half of the question?
Oh, it was
please?
Just do you see prospects for increased use of paraprofessionals to take some of the workload off of the
Yes. Just a couple of years ago, of course, expanded duties became law in Minnesota. And it was kind of the cart before the horse. We didn't have anybody to teach expanded duties. So it's taken us a couple of years to ramp up. And now even at the Hibbing Clinic, we're teaching expanded duties to our hygiene students. So we always have two hygiene students in Hibbing right now going through that course, learning how to fill teeth. Okay, that will help, I think, in the future. It'll make dentists more productive.
And just a lot of the pictures that we saw at the beginning here, a lot of that had to do with, I mean, it has to do with seeing the dentist, but it also seems like it has to do with daily routine care stuff as well.
I think when you look at state program patients and you look at the poor population in rural Minnesota as well as metro Minnesota, you're going to find that there's a general lack of dental IQ or awareness of what to do to keep healthy teeth. In programs such as Head Start have helped and different things that are going on. But there's such a pent-up need out there, and you see this all over the state. We really need to do a better job, especially getting to the children.
Representative Hunt?
What's the role of a primary care physician in looking at, they're often seeing these kids at an early age. Do they pay any attention to their teeth or not?
I think they do, yes. Obviously, a physician may see a child before a dentist at an earlier age. The ADA is now recommending that we see all children at the age of one. However, if a physician were to see something and refer them to us, we would try and get them in. But oftentimes, a physician cannot find a dentist to refer these people to.
Just a comment. Keep those pictures and keep sending them to us. I mean,
thank you.
Those pictures are worth thousands and thousands and thousands of words.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, I'm a family doc, and I want to address that last question.
Yes, please do. Well, and we're actually at the point where that's as perfect timing.
please, but just if you could just identify yourself.
I'm Dr. Jan Baldwin. I'm a family physician. I graduated from med school in the 70s, and I've practiced in rural care my entire career. The teeth you just saw, I see all the time. And my problem is twofold. One is almost no dentists in this area will see state program kids. Now, Jerry, I think you would agree with that. So even when I see teeth like that, I can't get these kids in any kind of a timely manner. So I've had to put kids on strong painkillers and try to get them to function in school, just waiting to see the dentist. And then when they finally get in, the extent of the work they need often takes multiple visits. You know, the horse is out of the barn, as you can see. So these pictures aren't exaggerations. These are very common among our poor children.
Any other comments beyond the dentistry?
I'm sitting on my hands back there. I came out of interest, and I have to tell you that I'm just really impressed with the level of the questions you folks are answering. Asking. This is very encouraging to me. I guess what I would say is those figures that you see with the rural health care shortage actually are very scary, but they're scarier in real life than they are on paper. First of all, I've just been informed by sitting here that we actually are not in trouble as far as health care. I actually have six partners in town who are over 60 or 65 that can pull the plug any minute. The second thing is most of us are older. The third thing is when you looked at that neat little graph from the Department of Rural Health of the physicians coming out, there's a difference in those graduates. For example, in internal medicine, who are often the people that take care of the elderly, only a very tiny minority of internal medicine graduates are going into primary care. Almost all of them are going on into cardiology, pulmonology, or subspecialist care. Those that do stay in general care often are going to a hospitalist program where they only work in the hospital. That works in a larger facility. We're probably at the edge of the size. We don't have a hospitalist program where it can work, and it could work if we do some, the hospital kind of reimburses it. You get into these smaller hospitals, and a hospitalist model does not work. So a lot of those internal medicine people you see on that graph are not accessible to us. I spend hours and hours on the phone trying to get recruits for this area. We're understaffed in all three of our clinics. There are more people that call our clinic every day than can be seen. We're trying to expand with mid-levels and practice extenders, but it takes time to train and obtain those people too. We're seeing a big change. The part that he mentioned with the what's coming out of the med school is really affecting us. Often the people coming out are really rural or urban people. They've had no rural experience. I personally went through the RPAP program, the Rural Physicians Associate Program. I spent a year in Fergus Falls. A high percentage of the, quote, younger physicians, my age and younger here, went through that program. Because in medical schools, it's an urban place, and they're basically telling you, oh, you're too smart to go into primary care. You should be an ophthalmologist or what brain surgeon, whatever specialty they are. So there's a big drain. And so I needed that little pearl in me that said, you know, rural care is okay. It's fun. I wouldn't do anything else. So a lot of these people that are graduating, even in family practice and pediatrics, aren't really accessible to us because they're not interested in rural care. And the second thing that's huge, and I know the dentists are hitting it too, is this what I call the spouse problem, is most professionals nowadays are married to another professional. And it's beyond a community putting up a little booth and saying, gee, Hibbing's a great place to work. Like the last recruit we tried to get, his wife was an art professor. We had artists in town taking her out to eat. We were trying to work with the community college, finding a job. And you know what? There wasn't a job for her. I mean, the community bent over backwards. Someone actually dropped the price of their lake place that she's an artist that has a studio and said, we'll sell it to you if you come. So the community is even trying to help us recruit. And it's just tough. They ended up going to Cape Cod. She can market her work and she can teach. So it's really a challenge for us. And so, yeah, go ahead, Chairman.
Yeah, no, I guess the other question I was, anything that you see in your practice, that trends that you're seeing in your practice from the patient side?
Older, sicker. I think this whole idea of chronic care is much, much a bigger burden to us than it might appear just hearing about it. For example, diabetes visits used to be pretty quick, and we didn't give as good a care. Now there are very stringent standards that they've shown if we have our diabetes people meet these criteria, they'll do well. And so the diabetes visits used to be maybe 10 minutes. Show me your blood sugars. Let's see your lab work. Now they're 15 or 20. So the complexity of the patients, the number of drugs people are on, and just people are living longer. You know, I've got patients that are in their hundreds, and some of these people are sick. So as the population ages, the complexity of the care is really a lot higher.
Any other questions? Representative Butt.
Just if either you or the...
You probably didn't expect to get on this. So
that's okay. Any way I can help rural medicine, I'll do it.
Well, either back to the issue of children and teeth, if you could give us some greater insight in terms of, is this changing? Is this a phenomenon that's increased over time in terms of very young children with poor dental care? Is it because of family income changes, demographic changes in the makeup of these families, nutritional changes in our culture, all of the above, and what is happening in the communities to try to turn it around, to give people earlier information that will prevent this? Because it's so horrible once it gets that far. You know.
Yeah, actually, that's a very good question. I guess what I'm seeing, and like I said, I've been in practice since the 80s, is it's getting worse, and I think it's multifactorial. I think the breakup of the traditional family has made a huge difference. I think Dr. Peterson is right. I do a lot of dental educating. When do you start brushing teeth? How do you do teeth with small kids? I think the little, you've all seen the toddler running around with the Kool-Aid sippy cup all day long. So we're seeing less milk in kids. We're seeing more soft drinks. Go down the hall in this high school, you see vending machines selling 20 ounces of Mountain Dew. So we're seeing a lot more of the carbonated, acidic, sugary beverages. And that access to care issue is just huge. Because by the time I notice it, the horse is out of the barn. But it is definitely getting worse.
Well, thank you. Oh, Representative Loughlin.
Well, just one quick question. I just wondered if it's sort of like in the last couple of decades in the city where I live that we lose our older people when they start to get frail and older because they go to live near or with their children who moved out to the exurbs or the farther away from the city, and then you have a loss of continuity of care. Are you experiencing that as well with sort of the newer old population who may have retired here to a lake cabin or something? Are you finding that they're staying here as they get into that frailer end? I mean, you have your own homegrown elderly, but I'm just wondering about the retirees. Are they staying here for their health care? Is their needs increase, or do they move back to wherever their children are?
In Hibbing, it's not as obvious because we're not as much of a vacation area as some other areas. You know, my own personal gestalt is the real frail elderly go back to wherever their children are now. To stay at the lake place, you have to have a certain level of health. What we're seeing more, my bigger problem, is the frail elderly whose kids have had to go south to the cities for employment or to Duluth. So I'm seeing more and more frail elderly without the intact family that provided a lot of the safety net that we used to have. And that puts a lot more pressure on the healthcare system because I have to do a lot more organizing, getting in the home healthcare. Is it really working for grandma? Is she safe at home? Where in the old days, I think the daughter or the niece or the son would have taken care of it. So it's more the aging in place that's stressing me.
Well, I just have to comment. I don't have a question for you, but you gave my speech.
Oh, thank you.
The number of U.S. medical school grads going into family medicine has dropped 60% in 6 years. So they're just not doing it.
And Representative Huntley, a lot of those people are working part-time. That's the other thing, is when you talk about the number of physicians, many of us women, because we're often in two-career couples, and some men, are working maybe 0.6 or 0.8. So each of those people is not necessarily replacing an older doctor.
The other thing I was going to say is that if you look, compare all the states, the two states that have the highest percentage of family practice docs are Minnesota and North Dakota. And those two states, there's a direct correlation between the percentage of family practice docs and the lower costs and higher quality.
Amen. But, you know, part of that is that continuity of care. I know them. I've taken care of them for years. I know their situation. So any help that you can give us to help fill our pipeline and help support us up here legislatively, we sure appreciate. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else in the audience that would like to speak or share anything? Yes.
I got one question for Dr. discriminate at all as to where the problem lies, as it were?
Yes, we had asked people where they were accruing that debt. Was it hospital? Was it physician, nurse practitioner, their healthcare provider? Was it pharmaceutical? Was it dental? Was it vision? And we had them break that out. So that is forthcoming as well. Stay tuned.
Well, there was one piece in your presentation that broke down. It broke down how much was going to providers versus others, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, the majority of debt was for that health care provider, that they owed money to their provider. And I just want to make one comment to kind of follow on the two previous comments. One of the things that I think we have to be really mindful of when we're looking at rural health is that when we have medical debt out there, that medical debt is not only a burden to that family, that medical debt is a burden to those rural providers. And our rural providers in North Dakota and nationwide are running on some very slim margins. And so if we see this problem in that farm community where we think they have pretty good insurance, or at least, you know, 94% of Minnesota have coverage, how does that then translate to other folks who may not have quite as good of coverage? Because ultimately, that debt is going to have impact on the viability of the health care systems in their rural communities.
Well, thank you, everybody, for coming tonight and for sharing this information. It's a lot. I think a lot of really good issues were raised for us, some of which we knew about, some of which we hadn't heard from. But it's very helpful to us to kind of get a sense of, to hear from what's happening in the community as opposed to just hearing it in the Capitol in an article or theoretically. And so I appreciate everybody coming out. And we will take this information and think about it. I'm sure each of us are going to have ideas that come out of this and hopefully generate some more discussion at the Capitol. I do want to thank Representative Sertich for hosting us up here. This is great, and it's fun to just come to this building. Thank you for the tour of the building. It is quite a place. So with that, I guess we will adjourn, and we'll be in Little Falls tomorrow. Thank you.